And for this evening's talk, we talk about the discovery and the following of meaning in your life. It's one of those big problems. What is the meaning of life? One of the answers to that is that life has a meaning which you give to it. And straight away, that answer is not as if that life has some sort of meaning which is out there, which some monk or nun or expert or wise person just gives to you. It's not as if, like in life, maybe your mother gave you life. But to be able to find the meaning for that, it's not something which is handed to you. But it's something which that you work towards, you find. Something which you learn throughout your whole life, the meaning. It's a lot of meaning which you give to your life, not which you take from somewhere. A lot of times that we depend upon others, experts, to tell us what to do, to give us our entitlements and our rights. We don't have a right to meaning. We earn our understanding of meaning, which is one of the reasons it's what we give to our life. And of course that is a journey which just takes so many years. And then we often say that if you think you know the meaning of your life, then it's like you're dead. You're not looking, you're not discovering, you're not opening to new understandings, deeper messages of truth. And I'm just reiterating what I said during the meditation, is allowing your learning to stand in the way of truth. It's almost like dying to this wonderful journey of discovery. It is when you allow the two types of spirituality or religions or philosophy, whatever you call them. The first is where you allow your beliefs to actually to bend the truth. And the other one is where the truth, the experience, what is right in front of you, bends your beliefs. Whether that's in science or religion. Sometimes I was just listening. I only half went through it. It was a video someone gave me, and apparently it was from Channel 9, about another boy with no brain. A boy was born with spina bifida, and was just the encephalitis in his brain was so severe. They were surprised that he'd even survived birth. But, and he only survived, but his brain grew over 2 or 3 years, stimulated by experience and learning. And it was something which the parents just gave out of love and care. It wasn't supposed to happen. The boy was not supposed to last even a week or two, let alone I think it was 4 when they stopped, when they filmed his incredible little journey, and showed that the brain had grown almost to normal over those 3 or 4 years. Why it could do that was just dumbfounded doctors, dumbfounded scientists. And it reminded me of my own science background. And I was theoretical physics at Cambridge University. That's pretty hard physics. But still there was so much which was weird and unexplained. Which sometimes you just, it's too difficult to put it in the anomaly basket. But every now and again you got great scientists. And those great scientists would never ever stop at their knowledge. They would always push and challenge and see deeper. And it was that saying I collect sayings to anchor my talks, anchor my life. The saying of, I would love to know the name of this fellow, but it's such a long time ago now. He was the head of Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, head of the medical school. And I heard this from one of the doctors who was driving me to a retreat, who said that at the beginning of his years in medical school, the head of the department, giving the welcome speech to everybody who was going to spend the next 4 years in Royal Prince Alfred Hospital Medical School, who said, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. This was the professor saying, what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years, 50% of it is wrong. The problem is, he said, we're not quite sure which 50% it is. And I always remember that saying as a great scientist. It was not dogmatic, it was not fixed, it was not saying, this is true, everything else is wrong. So when we're looking even for meaning in life, for what we're actually finding out in our life, it is a discovery which won't have an end. And if you have an end, and you get dogmatic, and you get, this is my policy, this is my religion, this is how it is, and you better believe in it, it's my way or the highway, that sort of stuff, you know there's a great rebellion which comes inside of you whenever, you know, you get forced, or even just tempted, cajoled, bribed to do something or believing something which you know doesn't make sense, which to you hasn't got a meaning. And so that's one of the reasons why that many times you find meaning in your life not by following what other people do, but maybe just getting in that profession, getting on that journey, but breaking new ground. You never stand in the shadows of your mentors, of the people who inspire you, of your leaders. Never stand in their shadows. You stand on top of their shoulders. You go further. It's one of the reasons why, even as a Buddhist monk, you know, you see the Buddha, you know about, read and study and get taught about his life, but you go further, taking it in new ways, new directions, new languages, new cultures, in a way which protects. Sometimes you think, am I just being disrespectful? Am I being sacrilegious when I take it into different ways? But then there's something inside of you which is my compass, the compass which you have to find meaning in life. And when you do practice enough mindfulness, enough awareness, instead of just reading the books and looking at the documentaries, you feel your reactions in your own heart and your mind, and just, you know, just how things react with you. And then there is something which is far more reliable, and that is just this very clear mindfulness and awareness of what is really useful and moral and ethical and good and meaningful and helpful in life. That is sometimes where, you know, the old saying again of your learning stand in the way of truth. We are asked to make moral decisions often in our life. And sometimes all of the books, all of the ethicists, all the philosophy, all the religions, everything your mother or father or grandparents ever told you, it's not enough. And sometimes even when I, you know, being a leader, and I have to make a decision, you stop. You don't think about it. Because it's the thinking is where we lose the plot. We feel it. We feel what's right and what is very, very dodgy, very wrong. You feel it. And because you've been practicing as a monk, meditating, sometimes being rebellious, not following others, trying to break new ground, it's one of the reasons why I became a scientist. Because I thought that that logical, based on evidence, research, that would give you a very solid ground to find the meaning, the truth of this existence. It was weird, isn't it? You're taught how to do maths, you're taught about do history, you know what, who did what, but why did they do that? What did it achieve? Where did it go to? The why and the wherefore. And for those of you who just want a little bit of deeper Buddhism, we use a word called Dhamma sometimes. This place is called Dhammaloka, the light of the Dhamma. And Dhamma, is it just the truth, the Buddhism? What is Dhamma? And I mentioned this to the monks the other day. This was a quote, not a quote so much, but an argument, a little essay from the great scholar Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he was mentioning this experience, this predicament, where you are right now. Trace it back. Why did this happen? Where did this come from? What are the causes, the conditions which make this? He said, that is called Dhamma. The causes, understanding the why. Similar to during the meditation, introduced as a bit keech, calling peaceometer, kind of get something a bit more interesting than peaceometer, because apparently, I don't know if they still do this, I remember when I was a kid watching elections, I had the swingometer, to see who was going to one political party, the left or the right. Do they still have that in elections? I don't know, anyway, the peaceometer gives an idea of just how peaceful, but the whole point was why? Why do you get more peaceful? Why do we get agitated? Because that went back to the whole idea of science. You get the causes, the understanding of the whys, and then that gives you some idea of just how we can make for a better world, make healthier human beings, make more peaceful people. Why? Have terrorism attacks. Why? Why did that happen? Find the causes of these things. So when we find the causes of these things, then it gives us meaning. Sometimes the tragedies in life, when a young person dies, why? Why did a person die at such a young age? It's trying to find meaning in a tragedy. And again, it's not that hard to find meaning. Why do these things happen? And to give life some meaning. Now, how it gives life meaning, I'm borrowing this from Ajahn Bhumali, because he borrowed it from me, we share everything, so much stuff. The meaning of when a person dies. And he didn't have a cup, a glass. I've got one right now. And this came from Ajahn Chah. Can you see the glass here? Can you see the crack in the glass? Can you see a crack in the glass? This is what Ajahn Chah would do to me. And I can't see a crack. I think my teacher's cracked. sometimes he'd be very innovative. Sometimes he'd do things. I remember the time when someone asked him, why did you ordain Ajahn Chah? And you ask, why did Ajahn Chah become a monk? You know the answer? He said that when he was a kid, in the villages of northeast Thailand. It was just an ordinary village, poor, they didn't have any computer games or any games or TVs or radios. They just make up games like kids do in poor places of the world. So one of the games, when they're fed up with playing football, or they would play like houses, they would play monks. So one of the kids would volunteer to be the monk and said, Ajahn Chah would always volunteer to play the monk. And what he would do, he would find a rock, he would sit on the rock, he'd get some brown cloth around him, and he'd sit there on the rock, but it was only about 4 or 5 at the time, and he'd ask all his friends to go get him something to eat. He said ever since that time, he always wanted to become a monk when he grew up. Of course, there's more to it than that, but it was very funny and engaging. And so when he was teaching us, he wouldn't just, you know, teach intellectual stuff. The intellectual stuff was there, but he would put it in a way which, whoa, you understood. The glass was cracked. What do you mean? He says, the crack is in here, but it's microscopic. It's called the crack of fragility. Impermanence. It's not going to last. One day somebody's going to drop this. One day, just carelessly, they're going to knock it and it's going to break and shatter. It's fragile, just like each one of you. One day, it could be a car crash, it could be travelling on a 370 MAX. I did check my flights the next couple of days. I don't think I'm travelling on one of those, so I should be back here in a week or two's time. But you're all fragile. Because you're fragile, does that make life morbid? I'm going to die. No. Because this is fragile, this is worth something. That's why we care for it. When we realize how fragile our relationships are, our life is, our planet, everything, even our Buddhist society, how fragile it is, it's cracked. It will break one day. That is why we care for it. The people you live with, do you take them for granted? Think they're always going to be there tomorrow, the next day? They're cracked. They're fragile. One day that crack will open up and they won't be here anymore. So, when we know that, it means that when tragedies do happen, we expected that. It would happen one day. We don't want it to happen. We know that this does happen. And number two, it's because we know how fragile relationships are, how fragile life is, how fragile health is. That is why we care for it. We care for it even more when we realize just how easy it is to break. That is the meaning which we can get from tragedies. It doesn't mean we cry too much. It doesn't mean we get negative or depressed or even suicidal. We look at the difficulties of life. Yes, there's something to learn from this. That the next person we meet, we're going to care for them. Look after them. It is as if the tragedies in life just make it more important just to be compassionate, selfless. Look after others. Look after our own life. We give it meaning. So this is where that in our life, kindness to others, service, you find that people, please excuse me, but sometimes people who do get depressed are looking at themselves. What I need, what I want, how life has been difficult and tough to me. But to look at somebody else, to meet someone else, to have empathy towards somebody else, to be able to get to know that we're in this journey together. We can't separate. And because of that, we have this wonderful opportunity to look after somebody else, to care for them, to give to them, to look after them. Why is it that sometimes that a little dog can take away just all the negativity, all of the hurt? When you see a little dog, just even like a puppy just crawling onto your lap, or just a little cat just rubbing against your... And these can be some very hard people in prisons. Some of those people in prisons, oh, they'd be just so tough. They're murderers, really tough guys, tats all over them, and scars as well. But then a little kitten would come into their cell, and that kitten gets loved to bits. And just see these tough guys, and they just get so soft towards a little animal. Somehow or other, they got somebody to care for and to love and look after. And that just takes away their own pain and difficulties. What we're saying here is that sometimes we get great meaning in service, great healing. We're not just thinking about ourselves and waiting for the crack to open. We're just realizing that we are being kind and caring to others. And then we also, just by kind and caring to others, there's a little bit of compassion, which is just so important. We don't know logically how it works. This whole organization, the Buddhist Society of West Australia, goes here from just when we first came over 36 years ago to see this place grow. How on earth? Did we ever have a plan? A grand plan? Just, you know, how are we going to do this? Just every day, every week, year, it grows because we're trying to be kind. Trying to look after one another. Not to be negative. Oh yes, not to be negative about if you want to be. But being kind, opening the door of your heart to this moment. It's never going to be a perfect moment. It's never going to be a perfect Buddhist society here in West Australia. That's why we're always talking in our committees and executive meetings what we can do and how we can do it better. And basically the same old arguments or same old discussions every week. Maybe the people change, maybe the... But it's always just, how can we make it better? Something so hard, but we get there. Slowly, yeah, but we get there. Sometimes it's a case of we can't reach too far to get meaning. One of those important moments, you know, when I was a young monk and I was helping another teacher, and this anecdote, I'm not sure when the last time I told it, but this happened in the fishing village of Oban in the northwest of Scotland. It was not the summertime when it's really beautiful. It was maybe springtime, maybe about this time, or maybe just February, cold, but we could hire a place to have a retreat. And it's really, if ever you've been to the northwest of Scotland, it's remote, it was peaceful, just a fishing village. With a, I thought it was a hotel or something. There's a nice retreat centre there. Austere. But a place where people could come just to do some meditation. And I was just listening to the same old stories again and again and again and again about not being able to meditate and not being good enough, having problems with the family and the same old, same old. And then this woman came in and she really shook me out of my lethargy and dullness. She said to the teacher there, "I've come here to thank you for saving my life." People can say that, but when it's real, when you really have had your life saved, you know, big time, I just woke up with the power of where that came from. And I was really interesting. Why? What had happened? What had happened with this woman? She told her story. Interesting story, that she was a student somewhere in Middle England, and she got a bit difficult with her studies, with her social life, with the pressures on any young woman trying to sort of achieve under pressure. And she got a little bit depressed. And the GP at the time this was maybe 40 years ago, the GP at the time just gave her some Valium. Just, you know, easy, take these pills. But she got addicted. Got addicted to Valium. And sometimes that some things are very hard to break off their addiction to. And I told the monks, I think on Wednesday night, I knew this gentleman who was addicted to brake fluid. To brake fluid. But he said he could stop at any time. That was a joke. Addicted to brake fluid, but he could stop at any time. Okay, a few people are scratching their heads and shaking their heads. Well, what can you expect from Ajahn Brahm? Anyway, being more serious, addicted to Valium. And when she comes on one of these retreats, they have these things called, you know, precepts, especially the five precepts. Sometimes people listen and they don't really understand totally. Only Buddhists are not supposed to take alcohol or drugs. Fifth precept. And it wasn't explained to her. This means, you know, non-medicinal drugs, like the recreational drugs. Nothing about sort of, you know, if you've been prescribed a medicine by your doctors. But she never understood that. She got it wrong. But on a retreat, when it's nice and peaceful, people aren't talking much to one another. They're smiling. They're kind. Everything is there. There's no stress. She could give up that Valium for 9 days. It was hard, but, you know, she could do it. And she started to feel what it's like to be without that drug in her system. Not totally, but then the problem came when the retreat finished. And she thought, I've done 9 days, let's see if I can carry on without the Valium. So, she decided to throw the pills away. But she never realized that being in a retreat, in a place of safety, where people are nice and kind, you don't feel that people are threatening you or putting pressure on you to be anything. But then she had to go through Glasgow to get back home. And that meant going through Glasgow railway station. If you've been through any terminus or station, it's just so distressing, it's so crazy. It's just people are all over the place, running this way and so noisy. It's like a chaotic environment. And she said that she almost has totally lost it. And of course, you can imagine when someone is that sensitive to actually to go through a railway station, not like Perth, I mean, think more like Sydney Central or the Victoria Station in England or something. It's a crazy place. And then she managed to get back home. Where she said that she spent the next, what was it, month, I think, just sitting in a chair, hardly able to do anything, as the effects of that drug slowly wore off. Now, this is not recommended for people to do such cold turkey. It was just by mistake she did this, because she started off misunderstanding about the precepts in Buddhism and had a supportive start and then just managed just to keep it together long enough to get back home and was just immobilized, just sitting in a chair. But she got through it. And she said, thank you. Because now she has her life back. A life which is clear and free. She said, thank you. And then she left. And I was so impressed, I remember that, and so many of the details, that I made a resolution. Arrogant young monk I was, said, if I ever do that and hear someone say that because of how I've served, whatever I've done, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for saving my life. I think my life had found its meaning. Just one, that's all I wanted. Just one. And of course, I have more than one. But can you imagine how that feels? when somebody says, thank you, what you've done really made a difference in my life. That you really just, you saved my life, you just turned it around in a different direction. You've helped me. I know sometimes it's too easy. Those effects, consequences, the karma of just hard work and compassion, wisdom, selflessness, looking after others. How when you've done that, just the return is enormous. Forget about superannuation. Just super karma. This is what really sort of makes your life worthwhile and have meaning. Caring and serving for others. And you know, it never gives you a big head. At least I don't think so. I've told my monks, if ever you ever think I've got a big head, just, you know, kick it. Remind me. Because sometimes, as monks, we sit up here so you can see me. We don't sit up here because we think we're superior or better. That's not the reason we do this. We hear so it's easier to see and to actually to give more. Because what happens when you do get addictions? Addictions to serving. To get, well, I don't know, it's a good high. The good high of actually helping other people. That's a meaning. But one of the problems is that you go so much, so far in service, volunteering, caring, going a bit extra, even though you're exhausted. Go a bit extra. But then what happens, you realize you can't continue like that, just being exhausted and giving. You need to also to have life's meaning, to find out where you can source that energy from. And there comes a time, just when you stop. You care for yourself, you give yourself the meaning. And this is sometimes when you allow this moment to be. And you appreciate just everything which is right here, right now. How peaceful and beautiful it is. Sometimes I spend my life, a lot of my life, when I'm in Bodhinyana Monastery, making sure it's a beautiful monastery. Making sure that it's harmonious, making sure it's well swept, making sure it's inviting but also peaceful, making sure it's a place the monks and the novices can feel they can come and live their monastic life and grow, and the plants can grow as well, and people can grow who visit and stay. But you know, sometimes I forget. It's recently just, we had the CEO of our local council shire just came for a visit. And when he came out of the car and I just greeted him, it was on business, but he just stopped and said, wow, this is such a beautiful place. And I stopped too and said, yeah, you're right. You know, how often, because I live there, I miss it too often. Just seeing just what a beautiful environment. 36 years, I think, there's so many people giving, caring, sweeping, offering funds to build. Oh, I've just built so much of that place myself. But it's just everybody helping there. All the people I've known. It's a beautiful place. It's not just the forest. It's not just the building. It's the whole history and the atmosphere. And that's what a visitor could see, which I just missed too easily. And that's why just all the good karma, all your goodness and kindness and generosity and love and forgiveness and peace, which every one of you has given over such a long time, maybe a little bit here, maybe other places, listen, your whole life, sometimes you forget to value that. See how important it is. The little things which accumulate is where the greatest meaning could be seen and found. Yes, easy to say, you know, somebody, you've discovered a cure for a cancer, you've discovered just, you know, how to solve some of the biggest problems in the world. But those are just the big mountains. Amongst those small mountains are just the rocks and the rivers and the creeks and the little animals who scurry around those valleys, or the birds, the people. Everything there is also contributes. It's too easy to see the great mountains without seeing just the little hills and the valleys. So easy to see the great monuments like a Taj Mahal, not to see the little huts of the people who built that for such a long time. So sometimes, many of the things which you have done and given and served and helped, often I say this, that sometimes you have to wait until you're dead before you realize the effect which you've had on others. Wait until people speak the eulogies, and then you can't hear them. Which is one of the reasons why every time I go to a funeral service, I think what a shame it is, the person who's in the box just, you know, can't hear just the meaning they gave to so many other people's lives. So that's why that gentleman in the United States who decided, okay, this is a bit of a pun, but here it comes, decided to think outside the box, decided to have his funeral service when he was still alive, just a week or two before he died. What a wonderful thing to do. You know, his death was going to happen. You know, it was, you know, predicted and almost unstoppable, some disease. But he decided a week or two before his demise to hold his funeral service, so he could be there and listen to the effect which he'd had on other people's lives. And he could be there to listen. So what a great idea that would be. But he also said that it's also, you could see actually who turned up for his funeral, while he still had time to adjust the will. No, that was actually just joking around. But still, you can see that sometimes people have such low opinions of themselves. People think, oh, just even some monks, some nuns think, oh, we can't teach, we're not good enough. My goodness, you are good enough to teach. Just at the recent 9-day meditation retreat, the Easter retreat which I gave, you know, because I was too busy and can't do everything. So I asked one of the nuns, Venerable Munisara, to teach the guided meditations. You were there, she did a really great job. So, oh, can't teach? Of course you can teach. Give people a chance. Get out there. And so many people think they can't. Can you teach? Can you serve? Can you be kind? Can you love? Can you forgive? Sometimes we think we can't. But places like this encourage you to break those invisible, meaningless barriers which stop you finding meaning in life. It's great when people just go past boundaries and they're alive when the doctor said they should have been dead. They should not be able to achieve things. They can't just learn to play the piano when they're 60, 70 years of age, and they're just great at it. Whatever it is, that sometimes our jobs is to encourage people, just, why can't you? Why not? Instead of, no, oh, I can't do this, why can't you? You know, there's some people, they come up to me and they say, oh yeah, I haven't got enough good karma. you know, to become a monk or become a nun or to do this or do that. And you know what I do? I say, wow, amazing that you know your past lives and your accumulated karma over many lifetimes that you think you can't do this. Wow, you're amazing. You're much wiser than I am. What you're saying is, why do we put barriers in front of ourselves, which are just excuses, just for not being courageous? Sometimes when I was a school teacher, some kids would think they can't do math, they can't do physics, they can't do science, they can't do sports. Who said? Recall this one kid. I was a math school teacher before I became a monk, in a high school. An interesting time there. And teaching math to one of the kids, that this, I was told that this kid came bottom the year before. And in his mind, he couldn't do math. He was hopeless at math. He just was there, just went through the motions in class. But I want to find out, is it such a case that someone cannot do math or cannot do sport or cannot do this? Why? So I just spent extra time with this kid. After every lesson, during the lessons, you know, when he got problems to do, I'd go by his desk and he'd understand that. I said, no, sir. I said, this. Oh, yeah, thank you. I gave him extra support, extra encouragement. It was unfair. It was biased. Because I gave him extra encouragement, it means I couldn't give the same to every other kid in the class. I just focused it, because I just wanted to find out for myself whether it's the case that a kid cannot do math. He came top at the end of the year. Blew my mind. From bottom to the number one in the class. Just needed encouragement and help and service. But most importantly, the self-belief. He could do it. Can you meditate? That's also my job. Of course you can. But sometimes you think you can't. That's the trouble. So a lot of the time to find meaning in life, we do push the boundaries. We do, not in a negative way, not out of selfishness, just to see what's possible. And to actually to experience the unlikely. It's not impossible. The unexpected. And that is one of the reasons why that life does become an adventure. It's not, oh, I know what's going to happen. Oh, I know what's going to happen next. It's a waste of time. Life is so depressing. The world is going to end. If it's not the Third World War, it's being overtaken by right wing or left wing or something. We need both wings to be able to fly. We're going to be, I don't know what's going to happen next, but all the negative economy is going to bottom out, and what else is going to happen? Climate change, yes, climate change. We're going to be invaded by aliens and on the way, you know. But sometimes, yeah, these are important things we should consider. But sometimes we get so negative we think it can't be changed. Of course it can be changed. Of course it can be healed. It's not as if we take these things, you know, without enough seriousness. We take these things seriously, but not with negativity, but with hope, with energy, with courage, with innovation. Innovation. Here we go, is my innovation example now. Because I like breaking new ground. When I went to South Korea a few years ago, when I went there, it was for the 2015 World Computer Congress in Daejeon. And I gave the keynote address. What the hell I was doing there, I didn't know. It's a computer congress. A big one. World Computer Congress, 2015. And I was there after the presidents and the ministers, the politicians, they gave all their speeches. And then to set the scene or set the tone for the 2015 World Computer Congress, you've got the famous IT, I was going to say idiot, but certainly I don't know too much about computing, as you sometimes know. You know, Ben Nibuto is the secretary sometimes. And what was that case? The ones I couldn't get things to work. And so you turn it off here and then turn it on again. And it worked perfectly. So, wow, these guys know so much about computers. Whatever it was. So there I was. If they didn't know how much I knew about computing. But that wasn't the point. It's what I didn't know about computing. That was why I was giving the keynote address. The way you could see things from a different angle. And that's when I held up, it was actually, we don't have these anymore, a bottle, a plastic bottle. You know the old plastic bottles which we banned from this place now? I held up like a glass of water and I asked them, what is this? And people were kind enough to actually answer. They said, you know, it's a plastic bottle, yeah. What else is it? And I pressed them. They didn't know where I was going in this because they hadn't heard this before. And because, you know, I was different. And because I was somehow or other the keynote address, they took me seriously long enough to actually play along with me. And they said, this glass is two-thirds full, it's shiny, blah, blah, blah. And I kept reading, what else is it? What else is it? Because what you're doing there is you're exhausting your knowledge. Everything you've been taught of what I was holding up in front of me. Until they said everything we knew about this. All the names, all the labels have been used up. And you know, a lot of times when I held this up, they thought, it's a plastic bottle. They thought they got the right answer, that someone was going to say, yeah, well done, you've got the prize, yes, that's what it is. Sometimes that's not understanding and finding meaning, as if, you've got it, well done. You know, you get an A in your meaning exam. There's no answer to this. There's no final truth. You keep on looking. As soon as you think you've got it, you grab it, you've understood it, you stop looking deeper. So what is this? You keep on looking and looking and looking until you get to the point where you see in this things which you have no label for, no description, things which you haven't been taught, you haven't learnt in English language class, you haven't learnt from anywhere. You're seeing it anew, afresh. You're learning. Going beyond what you've been taught. And that's where you find meaning. Meaning is not old stuff. Meaning is new. Finding sort of new ways of looking. New ways of understanding. That's why Buddhism has got some sort of form, but sometimes dogma. Sometimes you look at something and you take it deeper. Your mind, what is it? Keep looking and looking and looking. And don't think you've finished. Look. See what it is to be. What it is to feel. Why? And don't try and find some smart answers. Just keep looking. Deeper, delving, to find the meaning of life. It's not given to you that easy. You search, go deeper. Monks like me are just to help you on the road, and when you think you've known, to give you a big kick in the bum to show you haven't, and keep on going and see where you find the meaning of your life. In some of the most unexpected places, in tragedies, in disappointments, in happinesses, places where you never thought that we can find some meaning. So what's the reason for a talk like this? Is sometimes people give up, depressed, fed up, negative. This, I hope, shows you to keep on going. It's not a case you can't do maths or anything in life. Who said that? Prove them wrong. You keep on going. That gives your life meaning. Thank you for listening. That's where we break new ground with the three sadhus. So let's do it again. You know, somehow I put so much effort into giving a talk. Well, not really, but I pretend I do. So give it everything you've got. Okay, now 1, 2, 3. Sadhu. 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 That gives it much more meaning. So we've got some questions from overseas, first of all. From Poland, UK and USA. Oh. In order to give our life meaning, we have to have some desire. But doesn't Buddhism teach about stopping desires? Does it teach about stopping desires? They're asking me. You find out whether it teaches. See if you can take it deeper. Have some desires. Yeah. You know that I have some desires. I remember even the Buddha had some desires. I know Ajahn Chah had some desires. Because when he wanted to go to the toilet, he didn't just say, oh, go here, just urinate where I'm sitting. No, he had desire. That's the only way he could actually get up and go to the toilet. Otherwise, he'd have made a mess where he was sitting. It takes sometimes that we take these ideas. Buddhism is without desires. Buddhism is always compassionate. Buddhism... Look a bit deeper. You're just repeating this old knowledge. It is true that Buddhism teaching us to actually investigate desires. What do you want desires for? Why? That's what we look at. And a lot of times we let go and become really peaceful. This is good enough. Get so still, delightful. Desire to stop. But then is the time to actually to get up. You're not sitting still. You walk to the loo. No one else will carry you. How does Buddha's concept of emptiness relate to the meaning of life? Emptiness? Yeah, there is a time when we empty our mind of our concepts. So when you empty the mind of concept, then where is your concept of emptiness? That too has been emptied. So sometimes smart Alex, I was going to say smart asses, but I shouldn't really be too. Of course, it is true. In different contexts, we talk about emptiness. The other times, we have the meaning of life. Sometimes, after I leave here, I look at that donation box and I realize the concept of emptiness. Which means I'm going to have no meaning. Except to raise some funds to pay for the bills or something. So emptiness has its... Okay, what was this Zen story? There was a Zen monk who was wandering from place to place and he hadn't got any alms food for a couple of days. He was really hungry. And then somebody said, well, you know, we haven't got any food ourselves, but you see there's a restaurant over there, a really famous restaurant. And the owner of the restaurant is a very generous Buddhist. Now, she'll be able to give you something. So, he went to the restaurant And he asked to see the owner. And the owner said, venerable monk, so blessed for you come to my restaurant. And he said, what can I do for you? And he said, well, you know, I'm a bit hungry. He said, but you have to teach some Dhamma before, you know, I know you're a real monk. And so he stood up and said, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Sadhu, 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 she said. Sit down. And he thought, wow, I'm really my lucky day. I'm going to get a good meal today. See how she liked that teaching. And so she soon came, this big platter. Huge platter. He said, wow, I wonder what's underneath the cover, which was keeping it warm. And she presented the platter to the monk. You know what's going to happen next. And the monk lifted it up. There was nothing there. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form, monk. Eat emptiness. That's an old Zen joke. But, so sometimes that we use the things, there is such a thing as emptiness. But what do we mean by the emptiness? The nothingness. Because when everything is empty, then there's nothing which you're holding or keeping. You're free. You have no weight, no burden, no worries. When you are empty, you can always receive some more knowledge, some more wisdom. When my cup is full, you can't pour anything else in. When there's some space, some emptiness, then you can always add some more things. If you're full with your wisdom and knowledge, then you can't receive anything. Is thinking about the meaning of life more important than just having a peaceful day? Yeah, I sometimes spend too much time thinking about my life and not having my life. That's very good. So again, it's the thinking. It's not meaning. That's why I hold this up. To understand what this is, we have to go past thinking. Thinking, old ideas. Thinking creates, most of the time, thinking we get into negative thinking. It's one of the reasons why, instead of that story which I won't repeat here about pushing wheelbarrows. 7 days I've been pushing the wheelbarrow, because Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Liam, just they couldn't decide where they wanted this bit of earth. And I was working so hard on just one meal a day in the steaming, mosquito-ridden, sweaty jungles of northeast Thailand. 6 days, about 12 hours a day, pushing wheelbarrows, and I had enough. So why can't these monks decide? They don't push wheelbarrows, only the junior monks did. And I was really thin in those days. I didn't need exercise in those days. I needed rest. I needed to wash. I needed to sleep. I needed to meditate. And I got so upset, I started complaining. And that's when one of the monks said, pushing a wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And that famous, wow, that was such a great teaching. Whatever you do in life, thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it is easy. Thinking about the meaning of life, don't think about the meaning of life. Just do it. Having a peaceful day, sometimes it's in the peace of the day you find meaning. Where you least expect it, you find great meaning. Too much time thinking about my life, I agree. What was it that John Lennon used to say? Life is what happens when you're busy planning something else. So, enough thinking. Now is the time for stopping. Any questions from the floor? Thank you. No? Good. Great. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So it's 9 o'clock now. So we're going to just pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then those who have legitimate questions, they can please come up and ask.